Welcome to this week's Married with Clickers, episode number 5. This week, Kat and I will be discussing the 1995 adaptation of Shakespeare's Richard III. How are you this evening, Kat?
I'm fine, although I do think it may be the winter of my discontent.
It is. It always seems like we're recording on these freezing
nights. I know, we're sounding like whiny Canadians, but we did wake up to a frozen pipe this morning.
Yeah, we did. And, you know, we're going to give people the impression that it's always cold in Canada, but it's really only in the deepest, darkest evenings in January.
True enough.
So, speaking of winter of our discontent, Richard III will be coming up, but why don't we run through some of what we've been watching lately?
Sounds good.
I've been on the edge of my seat, very excited for the return of Leslie Knope in Parks and Recreation. After a long hiatus, I think mostly baby-related, but probably partly low ratings-related.
Yes.
Parks and Recreation was back last Thursday. How'd you like it?
You know what? I was surprised that I was able to get back into it, because it was a rather long hiatus. I like how they address the hiatus by saying that they were all on leave. I guess they'd had to take a temporary leave from work, and so they focused on what each person had been doing during their unemployment. And I thought that was pretty amusing. Working at Foot Locker.
Yeah, the Foot Locker shirt was a good one.
Yeah, painting landscapes.
Painting landscapes. I thought it was good, but my problem with this show and like a lot of shows, I think almost too many characters start to get introduced and they try to spread the time amongst all of them.
Right, to keep the actors happy or to remind us who everyone is if for those with memory issues.
Right, so you got
like
20.
Me.
Yeah, you got 22 minutes. 10, 12 characters to each give airtime in 22 minutes, and it doesn't always work out. We had way too little Ron Swanson this time around, I think.
I almost think you have to view it as a pilot, and I think pilots can be problematic, so it almost felt like that to me.
You're right.
It's like a pilot.
It felt like they were really trying to engage new viewers with that whole intro about the two.
Yeah.
For sure. Okay, now guilty pleasure time. The Bachelor is back.
The Bachelor is back.
Quite literally, Brad Womack.
Yes.
That dog from Texas who turned down two bachelorettes quite wisely, I think, last time.
I think quite wisely. The poor guy. I mean, he's just being raked over the coals for that one, huh? And now he's become a bit too introspective, I think. And I'm not so sure about his therapist because he seems to be dealing with his past problems by macking on every woman he sees.
That therapist, I get the idea that they went to school maybe in Antigua, Bahamas at best.
Yeah.
Apologies to those fine islands. But this therapist didn't seem too professional.
No.
Just a pat on the back and you're out the door.
Yeah.
Brad Womack. I was thinking he's either the most earnest bachelor in the world or he's just a big fat liar.
Why?
Yeah, he's so endearing. You know, he just cares so much. He doesn't want to hurt anyone's feelings.
Yeah.
When you talk to him, he stares and nods and says, like he's really listening.
Yeah, he's dealing with some pretty fragile women this time.
They're completely nuts.
Yeah. Okay.
But they haven't.
To put it delicately, they're nuts.
It's a medical term.
Yeah.
But they haven't gone nutty enough for me yet.
There are a couple that are on the brink, though.
I'm looking for some fist fights.
Okay, yeah.
Some better quality stalking
than
we've seen.
Yeah.
Just hasn't been there yet. Do you have any early favorites? We haven't watched this week's episode. Hopefully we'll catch it after recording, if I have my way. Any favorites so far?
I'm going to have to think about that one. No, maybe the woman who lost, the race car driver's widow.
She's very nice.
Although they weren't married.
Ricky.
Out of wedlock, yeah. Ricky.
Ricky's fiance
mm-hmm.
with little baby Ricky.
Mm-hmm.
Don't
Ricky
mean to
Bobby, her. Sorry.
My favorite so far is the one that looks like Jennifer Garner's stunt double.
Oh, yeah, she's got...
With those ears
yeah.
sticking out the side.
Yeah.
Anyhow, we'll see. The money's on either Ricky's mommy... Or Jagar stunt double.
All right.
Now, it's been a fairly short week, and you, have been socializing. I've seen a couple movies on All By My Lonely Self. Netflix Canada helped me get through the evenings. Why don't I just run through those quickly? First night you were out, you had book club, I think.
I did.
I watched a Hong Kong Kung Fu movie from 2008 called Ip Man. Now, Hong Kong, Kung Fu, Eastern movies, it's not really... my thing. I like them, but I've never really... It's kind of a big blind spot in my cinematic knowledge. But I will really recommend this one. It was great. Actors were tremendous, very charismatic. The setting was great. Super production values. I think one of the reasons I didn't get into Kung Fu as a kid is because we had this multinational, multicultural channel here called Channel 47. Remember Channel 47?
I do.
And they show kung fu movies all the time, but they were the worst prints, yeah, like lowest production value ones. This one looks good. It's like at that Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon production value level. Really great so set.
Not laughable, like not some laughable of the ones you would have seen on Channel 47.
No, and its setting is set in the 30s, right, the late 30s, right when Japan has invaded China, so there's this great historical context to it. And it's really, really good, and I think it was a huge hit and has had a couple of sequels already. So the Ip Man, and it's about this guy who, I don't know how accurate it is, but I think this much is true. Big master, and he ultimately trained Bruce Lee. And the next movie I saw is a movie from last year, I think, called Triangle. It's kind of sci-fi, kind of horror. I had heard a lot about it before this. Thank you very much, podcasters, who spoil everything. But I heard it was good, worth a watch. It's kind of a bit of a mind bender. It deals with sort of time loops and time travel. But I went into it knowing way too much.
Okay.
So if you were watching it totally fresh, there'd be this whole period of discovery you go through where things are revealing themselves. But I pretty much think I knew how the whole movie played out. So watching a movie from that perspective, this one didn't work for me. If you're going to go see this movie, Triangle, it's kind of recommended, but it'd be much better.
So I'd enjoy it because I have no clue what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's Triangle.
Okay, excellent.
It's about this triangle, and it's giant, and it attacks New York.
Okay, perfect.
So that was Triangle. Then, it's pretty good. Then together on the weekend, we watched Michael Douglas in Solitary Man.
Yeah.
One of these later in life Michael Douglas movies. He's now everyone's favorite guy because he had cancer.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel for him. And yeah, in this tough movie, he plays a guy sort of dealing with his mortality.
Yeah.
What did
midlife
you think?
Crisis or latter life crisis. Well, I think he played that old and pathetic character extremely well.
Yep.
You know, there's a lot of pathos in the movie. You know, he had had those indiscretions, romantic and financial, and was coping with that. I liked it.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good, and Douglas seems to be doing this thing very well. I think Wonder Boys would have been the first one we saw where he was sort of the older Lothario type character.
Right.
And he does it pretty well. I don't know that I've ever really loved Michael Douglas. Like, when I was a kid, I liked Romancing the Stone, but I was never too into the, even Wall Street. You know,
yeah,
it's fine, whatever. People just loved him, but he never did much for me. I think I'm liking this older Michael Douglas, sort of post-Wonder Years. Wonder Years. What's it called? Wonder Boys.
Wonder Boys.
Like that King of California one with Evan Rachel Wood.
Yeah,
remember that
good
one where he was digging for that buried treasure?
Yeah.
I thought he was really good in that. Like,
that was good.
Going sort of, you know, pretend he's no longer gorgeous. Although in this one, he wants to still be gorgeous, but it's pretty clear he's not.
Although to some people he was, obviously.
To some people he was. He still had no trouble with the ladies.
Yeah.
And he's a 70-year-old man without a dime to his name, and he's still doing pretty well with the ladies,
that's
I guess.
Right.
So Solitary Man, I'd give it a bit of a mild recommendation. It just kind of meandered a bit.
Yeah, it did meander. It did drag. Yeah.
And I felt like I'd seen this movie before. I'm not sure where, but, you know, it's got too many elements we've seen pulled in from elsewhere, probably.
Soon to be your life.
It was my life, and I've lived it once. I don't need to see it on the big screen without an authorization.
Exactly.
Okay, so I guess we'll head into break before coming back to talk about Richard III, but quickly, I wanted to send out a few thank yous. I've needed a lot of technical support on this whole recording business, so I really want to thank Mike at Chinstroker versus Punter, as well as Rick and Will at the GGTMC. That is tough to say. I don't know how they say it all the time. For all of their help, man, I'd be totally dead without you guys. We'd be staring here with a computer not plugged in at all, basically.
Yeah, okay.
We'd be at that level. If you have any thoughts, please send us an email at marriedwithclickers@gmail.com, or you can call our hotline at 206-338-0793. And from the UK, I take it, it's 001-206-338-0793. And there's a prompt for sending a fax, but please don't send a fax. Emails or phone calls are best.
We're paperless.
We will be right back with that rudely stamped guy, Richard III.
Yeah.
Okay, you're back with Married with Clickers. We're here to talk about the 1995 film version of Richard III. We watched this for the first time together.
We did.
Way back when? Yeah. 1999 or so?
Oh, yes. It was a long time ago.
And was that your first time seeing this version of the movie?
It was. Yeah,
I don't think I did either. We were living in Halifax at the time. I was definitely in Halifax when it first came out. Not a town well known for its art house cinema.
No, definitely not.
No. The Adam Sandler films played very well there. Waterboy was playing on six screens.
Yeah, Waterboy.
But no Ian McKellen. It wasn't any of those X-Men movies just yet.
No.
So, to think he went from this to the X-Men and Lord of the Rings.
And Lord of the Rings, I was thinking that too. Wow.
So we saw this together, and I think during that process, we both discovered, this was right after we met, that it was our favorite Shakespeare play.
It is, absolutely. Yeah.
So we both studied it in school at some point, fell in love with it, fell in love with that little hunchback creep known as Richard III.
We're not the only one that loves the guy. There are like societies out there, Richard III societies. I remember reading that somewhere. There's one in Canada and the US and probably, I'm sure, in England too, but basically defending the accounts of Shakespearean accounts of him. And defending his character against Shakespeare's claims that, you know, that it was just Tudor propaganda and that Richard III was not responsible for half of those murders.
I try to stay away from the Tudor press.
Yeah, you do. Right?
Full of lies.
That's right.
Pack of lies.
Yeah.
It's sort of like the Fox News of the 15th century, I'd say.
Yeah.
But that's the boring version of Richard.
That's the boring version, yeah. That's always been the thing with Shakespeare, right? There's a bit of artistic license taken, I think.
Yeah, and that's what makes him fun. I first, when I was in grade 10, I saw a 1988 production of it at Stratford, Ontario, starring Colm Feore as Richard III, great Canadian actor. And, you know, I'm some 15-year-old schmuck, probably. I could really care. And I just saw this play, and I was like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, it was incredible. And
he's a riveting character person.
Yeah, and I just got obsessed with him. Mm-hmm. Not to the point where I started a society, of course.
Or walked with a hunch or anything.
But the other reason I'll never forget that night is we were on a school trip down to Stratford. On the 2-hour drive back to Toronto, we were in the school bus, September 1988, listening intently to the radio to the Olympics in Ben Johnson's 100-meter final.
Ah, that would be exciting.
It was very exciting. Turns out we witnessed two villains that evening.
Yeah.
Two really bad guys.
Yeah.
Ben the First and Richard the Third.
That's right.
I think Ben did get a bit of a hunchback later, but it might be some steroid
related, yeah.
So, and I don't think you've seen it live, but you saw
the Olivier version whenever that was done.
Yeah, so that's like the mid-50s, I think, the Olivier version. It was a much more traditional version. He's got the page boy haircut.
Yeah.
He's got the Prince Valiant going on.
Oh, dear.
But that's a good version.
Yeah, it was. It's well done. I mean, it's, like
it's
you said,
proper.
Traditional.
It's traditional.
Yes.
It's a nice, proper British version. Strong cast, strong acting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this 1995 version, directed by Richard Longcrane, who has done some interesting things, and the thing we know him from the most is that Gathering Storm, the Albert Finney as Winston Churchill.
That was excellent.
Excellent movie, the time leading up to the Second World War. And more recently, he did the, we haven't seen it yet, but you know they've had that series of Michael Sheen as Tony Blair movies.
Yes.
And the new one's called...
Isn't Michael Sheen Tony Blair?
I think they are. I've never
they're
seen
the same person, are they?
Never seen them in the same place.
Yeah.
Twice. They're like Snuffleupagus, Big Bird thing going on. So that is called The Special Relationship, where Dennis Quaid plays Clinton.
Okay.
And Sheen is Tony Blair, of
yeah,
course.
Yeah, I think I've heard of
so that. So that's his most recent work, I think.
Yeah.
So, but the screenplay was written by McKellen. And Shakespeare did a bit of the
Shakespeare
too.
Might have contributed a little bit.
Because McKellen had been touring with this version of the play for years. And it had been a big hit. And I think I read they were trying to do it as a miniseries, BBC, I take it. But then they decided it was worthy of a feature.
Yeah, well, I think it was.
I think so for sure. Because he managed to gather a terrific cast. McKellen and is as Richard III. Annette Bening's in there.
Yeah.
Robert Downey Jr. Jim Broadbent, who's been nominated for a lot of awards in recent years. Kristen Scott Thomas.
Where is she these days?
Yeah, well, she was everywhere in the mid-90s. I don't know where she is. And Nigel Hawthorne, who later went mad as King George.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific cast. And we get rolling with the film, and right off the bat, we realize this is non-traditional. We get the little bit, and my Shakespearean knowledge is so gone, whatever the heck you call the start of the play, where they lay out the setting.
Yes.
You know, the War of the Roses is in full whatever, and it's coming over the ticker tape.
Yeah, that was interesting.
So
and it's quite silent, too. I mean, I don't think there's any music. You just hear the tick-tick-tick-tick-tick-tick.
Yeah. So that helps to establish the time right there, for sure.
And also that feeling of suspense, too, and atmosphere, I think.
And then we really figure out what's going on, that the War of the Roses is in... It's War of the Roses, right?
Yeah.
It's in full, full form, because that tank comes crashing through the wall.
Yeah, that was subtle. What made you realize that it wasn't set in Shakespearean time? Was it the tank?
That was. I then had to look up the encyclopedia as to when the armored tank was invented.
But wasn't that great when all you could hear was him breathing through the mask, too? Just like...
Yeah.
Well, you'd like it. It's like Darth Vader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a lifetime asthmatic, I always have a soft spot for the wheezy types.
That's right.
Darth and anyone in a gas mask.
Yeah.
And you could just tell who that was stepping out of that tank,
eh? Oh, yeah.
You just know from his gait and his posture that that's Richard himself.
Yeah.
Who takes out the king with a bullet through the head, and we're underway.
Done. We're done. Yep.
This ain't Grandpa's Richard III at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
So we then transfer to the Yorks have won the war for the time being, I guess, and we go to this royal ball. A very elegant production.
Mm-hmm. The costuming's fantastic too, I think.
Fantastic. And through this royal ball, which is mostly dialogue-free, we get glimpses of the major players in the play.
And he's just lurking, right? The whole time, you feel his presence, but he's sort of just lurking, taking in the scene. You feel like you're lurking with him, spying on the...
Yeah, almost to the point where they almost should have done a point of view, a perspective camera kind of going through through the hall, because he is just glad-handing everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Got a little sick smile on his face. And then we really get what I guess this play is best known for, his big soliloquy, which is, almost the very start of the play itself, probably about 10 minutes into the film here. And I thought it was done in a really cool way.
Yeah.
So the first part, the Winter of Our Discontent, Made Wondrous Summer, all of that stuff is sort of done. He's giving a speech.
Speech, yep.
So it's not really a soliloquy at this stage because people are listening and reacting.
Mm-hmm.
He's giving this great sort of State of the Union speech about how great things are for the Yorks.
Right.
But then the second half, which is slightly more sinister about his conniving, he does in private.
Right.
So there's that break.
Yeah.
And I'd never seen or heard that people have divided up that.
No, I don't think I've ever seen that either.
In two different ways.
Unique.
So he's giving this great speech, and the next thing you know, he's taking a leak in the loo.
Wasn't that great?
That's definitely non-traditional Shakespeare right there.
But, it obviously makes our relationship with him fairly intimate as an audience.
That's true.
Right.
And I think that's what hooks you in, right? That opening soliloquy. You're on board with Richard.
If I'd seen someone pee, then I feel pretty close to him, I guess.
And he's the underdog, right? He's telling you everything, and I've been so rudely stamped, not fully formed. Come on, love me. And you're with him, I think.
Yeah, sure.
So after that, he breaks the fourth wall here. He speaks right to you. Mm-hmm. And he does this throughout the film. He just turns suddenly and
speaks. I love that.
Yeah.
That was such a, it could have been distracting, but it was really effective.
Yeah, he did just the right moments, I think.
Yeah.
Wasn't overly done, but every now and then he turned on the camera just to remind you he's speaking.
And that we're in on it. Didn't you feel like, we were his confidant almost? Yeah. I love that.
So I guess Clarence gets sent to the tower.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to talk a bit about Nigel Hawthorne in this role, because I think he's just fantastic. Actor from the Yes Minister, Yes Prime Minister days.
Yep.
We Yes Prime Minister,
yes.
Not Prime Minister. And Madness of King George.
Yes, he's great in that.
And Clarence is, I guess, one of the more sympathetic roles because he seems like such a nice guy.
I know.
And he goes down first.
Yeah, and he just, he has such an affinity for Richard, too. And just to be double-crossed like that.
And he gives this speech on the top of the tower about how he had this terrible dream about drowning and stuff. And it's not too long before he's in the tub getting his throat slit. And it reminded me of that painting, the...
Surratt?
Yeah.
Surratt?
Is that what it is? I wrote it down here. The French guy.
French poet, right?
Yeah, I don't know where on earth I wrote that down. I thought I wrote that down. Marat, Jean-Paul Marat. Yeah. But that's totally what it made me think of at the time.
I know, exactly like that.
So that was great. So Clarence is dead, and then we meet Kristin Scott Thomas's Lady Anne, who's mourning her dead husband, the king from... Oh, jeez, I can't remember his name now. My British history's gone. The guy Richard Shaw threw the head. Yeah. You know that guy.
Yeah, Edward.
Edward. And she's mourning him. Is that Edward?
No, there's another Edward. Sorry.
Too many Edwards.
Yeah, no, Timmy.
Let's just call him Timmy.
Yeah.
So King Timmy is dead.
Yeah, no, because
Kristin Scott Thomas is in the morgue.
Timmy.
Morgue mourning poor King Timmy with the bullet through his head. And his assassin, Richard, shows up in the morgue.
Yeah. That's,
and starts hitting.
It's pretty ballsy. What can you say? It's ballsy.
Starts hitting on her.
Yeah.
He's not even waiting for rigor mortis to set in here.
Yeah, no.
He's making his move.
Yeah.
And he says something. Like, I can't remember the line.
Was ever woman wooed in such manner or something to that effect?
Well,
like,
no.
No, but.
She hates him.
Lady Anne. Yes.
Lady Anne hates him, spits in his face.
Yep.
But eventually hooks up with him.
She's like one of the contestants on The Bachelorette.
Yeah. She's really good. So she's in with him now. And they've hooked up. And then we move on to this weird luncheon banquet.
Mm-hmm.
Where we really realize that even within the York family, not everyone loves Richard so much.
Mm-hmm.
King Edward, the old guy,
yes,
has his wife. And this is the problem. It gets confusing. Right?
Yeah, there are too many Edwards and Jameses and Henrys.
So his wife... Queen Elizabeth, but not the only Elizabeth in the film.
That's right.
Is played by Annette Bening.
Yes.
And her brother, Rivers, is played by Robert Downey Jr. And they obviously have a hate on for Richard here.
Yes.
Now, Annette Bening in the film is an American,
mm-hmm,
which I really thought, I only thought of it this time watching, I never clued in before the last time, but I think they're talking about making it a Wallace Simpson, the one who married that the Duke of Windsor, where he had to abdicate the throne from the 30s.
Okay. Right. And
you know
that's
that one?
Why.
I really felt like they were making a point. This is in
because
the 30s, kind of.
Yeah.
And she was American in this. And she kind of plays that Wallace Simpson is her name,
okay,
who married the Duke of Windsor, Edward at the time. Let's just say Edward.
Okay, go with
maybe
Edward.
George or Edward, and he had to abdicate the throne back in the 30s.
I appreciate that take on it.
You know,
because
I
don't know how I felt about her.
No, but I think that's what they were trying to do, because it does seem odd that they have an American, and Robert Downey Jr. plays an American,
right,
but they're both doing that. I'm American, but I'll speak like this affected kind of,
right,
which always works a bit funny in Shakespeare.
Yeah, it was problematic for me, but I can get into that later.
Because I read that McKellen wanted Downey Jr. in this movie because they'd done that movie Restoration together, where everyone just had full-fledged British accents. But he obviously didn't do the British one here. He was doing the American, and I don't know about it.
No.
That affected American.
Mm-mm. Not good for me.
Yeah. It should have been pure British.
Yeah.
But Edward, just before he dies, I don't know what he was dying of. Let's just say consumption.
Yeah, I think so.
Something consumptive related.
Yes.
Some sort of lungish disease.
Yeah, there was some wheezing going on.
A lot of wheezing, some coughing, a few gas masks given to him.
Yeah.
Just before he dies, he tries to bring peace. And everyone's like, I love you too. We're the best friends. And they're not really the best friends. And I looked this up. Remember that really... it almost looked Moroccan castle.
Yes.
On that cliffside.
Yeah.
That's a place called Brighton Pavilion. It's in Brighton.
Okay.
And it was a royal residence at some point in the 19th century.
Oh, I'm glad.
So it was one of their summer palaces, I guess.
Yeah.
Really weird looking place.
Yeah.
But I think it was the Indian influence.
Definitely.
Which is why it was designed like that. It was built right around 1800, 1810 or something.
Interesting.
So I think it has some of that Indian influence coming back from the colonies. Through the empire, right back to the UK. So that place is called Brighton Pavilion, and I guess it's a big tourist spot now.
Okay.
Which is, it's something else I want to mention. The locations they chose in this movie were fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Some really, really great spots.
Yeah.
Like, that one really stood out. We were just like,
what
the hell is that place?
Yeah, it seemed like they had left England, actually.
So, if you know the story, you know Richard's getting closer to the throne.
Mm-hmm.
He's off to, the king's dead.
Yep.
His brother Clarence is dead.
Yep.
But this leaves two surviving princes. They're sort of the Harry and William of their time, I guess.
Right.
Youngish.
Impossibly cute.
Impossibly cute. Receding hairline.
Receding hairline.
It's a bit of bad behavior.
Large teeth.
But they're next in line, and Richard is conveniently appointed as their protector, which isn't really a good idea.
No.
This is like Jason Voorhees being your camp counselor, I think, you know? It's like a bad idea.
Yeah.
Michael Myers is babysitting everyone in Hatfield, Illinois. So Richard's in charge of the boys, and you know where they're having their sleepover?
At the tower.
The tower.
Yeah.
And then one of them's like, I don't think that's a good idea.
Yeah. Although I read that it wasn't, that was the norm, that they would actually stay in the tower.
On one of your Richard apologist sites?
Yeah, I was curious what they had to say.
They slit their own throats.
Yeah, that's right. They suffocated themselves.
So they're off to sleep in the tower. Oh, and that station where the Prince of Wales, who's next in line, he comes off a train.
Yes.
And he was just so lame.
Effeminate.
Very feminine. And he's dressed just like Captain Crunch.
Yeah, Captain Crunch.
If Captain Crunch had feathers in his hat. Because he had
or
those.
Yankee Doodle or something.
He had those epaulettes.
Yeah.
Those yellow epaulettes. He had a blue jacket, the yellow epaulettes, and this feather cap. If put on a mustache on the guy, just like Captain Crunch.
Yeah, you got it.
And there's that scene where someone grabs Richard by the shoulder, by his hunchback.
Oh, yeah. The boy.
The boy,
yeah,
does. The younger prince. And he just rages.
Yeah.
And you see he's got this animalistic
side to him.
Yeah,
right?
We haven't really seen that. You know, he's just so tightly coiled. He's ready to pounce. And then the next stretch of the movie is really him playing political figures off themselves, mm-hmm. trying to slowly get people on board with him. He uses a ton of reverse psychology.
Yeah, quite effectively.
It's kind of brilliant. I wonder, like in literature, going back then, I wonder how much reverse psychology was used. It must have been pretty novel for the time.
I think so.
Because it's pretty cool. And we start to see Richard's more fascist ideas, I guess. Just the way he dresses and the people around him start to wear these black uniforms.
Yeah, and the flag.
That red flag.
With the boar's head, which I think would have been the... Was that the York?
I think it was his house symbol, but the way it was designed looked so much more like it was in Berlin than London.
Definitely.
In the 30s.
Yeah.
And those black uniforms, they started to look like SS troopers, sort of.
Yeah, completely.
So the
And the propaganda film, too, where he's being crowned.
That's right.
That was great.
Yeah, so that was just... So we're getting all of this sort of... These notions of Nazism and fascism coming in here. And it's quite cleverly done.
Mm-hmm.
But at this stage, the downfall really starts, and I think it really starts with the death of the princes. Spoiler alert! so the princes are which
I wonder why that had to happen if they had proved that they were illegitimate.
Yeah, I don't know. They were trying to prove that. I don't know if it was ever proven or whatnot. And at some stage, I guess he thought they'd always come back and assert their right to the throne,
right?
Or whatnot. So they're better off dead.
Sure.
When
you're on a roll.
When you're
going.
On a roll, why not?
He had a very effective go-to guy. Was it what's his name?
Terrell.
Yeah. He liked killing.
Terrell's the bag man. Yeah, he didn't mind. He's like, he didn't even have to ask him twice.
Yeah.
He was good to go.
Not much of a conscience.
No, it was like, do five or six ones free kind of thing.
Exactly.
You know, he's good.
Never heard what his reward was, but anyway.
No. So we learned that his wife, Lady Anne, a junkie,
mm-hmm.
that kind of came out of nowhere. So she's pretty useless, and he's ready to get rid of her. His best friend, Buckingham, played by Jim Broadbent, even starts to grow sort of weary, a bit suspicious. He thinks things are going a bit too far.
Yeah.
And I found it very interesting that Richard's mother, played by Dame Maggie Smith, has that great speech where she almost like, plays like the soothsayer in Julius Caesar or something.
Yeah.
You know, she really sort of tells him what's going to happen to him.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not all
and
wrong.
And she's cursing him too, right?
She's
Which is common.
Him. Right.
And that was, you know, you do not want to be cursed.
No.
Who does?
She curses him, foresee his demise here.
Yeah.
And we learn the young, heroic Richmond, played by the very dashing Dominic West.
Mm-hmm.
Is ready. He's headed off to France, and he's gathering an army to take to come back to England and claim the throne.
And also during this latter part too, we're seeing his paranoia, right? And which I thought was interesting, just to see how Richard III was becoming more paranoid. He's having these nightmares.
Waking up in a sweat,
right?
Almost doubting himself sometimes.
Yeah.
But he's losing his support network at the same time. So he's really doomed himself here.
Which is sort of like what it seems to happen with most dictators, right?
Yeah, for sure. You get
that paranoid.
It's the Hitler syndrome.
It is. Yeah.
For sure. You're right. I just want to talk about one bit of acting in that train car scene where he and Benning are really going at it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was the strongest acting in the movie.
Yeah.
I really felt she went toe-to-toe with him quite well there.
Yeah.
I'm not the world's biggest Annette Bening fan.
Yeah, I have problems with her.
Because of the non-English accent?
I hate to be a traditionalist, but I think... Well, I mean, I think my Achilles heel with it is just that she... You can either do Shakespeare or you can't.
Right.
It's like you can either rap or you can't.
Do you think she can rap?
No, I don't think she can rap.
Nor do Shakespeare.
No.
Oh, she's 0 for 2.
Yeah, no.
I hear what you're saying, especially because she's just surrounded by these greats.
Yes.
And for me, of the cast, it was Downey Jr. that was the furthest down the
list. Oh, yeah, he was too, but he was minor enough.
Yeah, he was minor.
It bothered me. He bothered me tremendously.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No,
I love you. Post-rehab.
She had a big role, but she has sort of, you know, a weak voice and all of that.
Yeah.
And I thought she did a good job. I thought she was really strong in this scene because she had been weak earlier, but she kind of went toe-to-toe with him here, but I totally take your point. And then for the last 10 minutes or so, this turns into a battle movie.
It's
a big fight scene. Well, you know, war is on and war is war.
Yeah.
And in the play, this is where people are like running on and off stage all the time.
Right.
Let's go get those guys. And they run off. And then someone comes from the other direction. We must retreat.
Yeah. And it's always a bit overly dramatic, which it was, right?
Yeah.
In the film, too.
And it really comes down like a showdown between Richmond and Richard III. And Richard kind of goes out in a very strange blaze of glory, I would say.
Yeah.
Very odd ending.
You mean with the falling?
With falling, too. And they're playing Al Jolson singing Sitting on Top of the World.
Yeah.
Which I know was a tip of the hat to a James Cagney movie from the 40s called White Heat.
Where he goes,
you know that one? He's like,
yeah.
On top of the world, rah! And right before he dies.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was that. But that music, I guess, is one thing I wanted to talk about. It was interesting that they played so much sort of 30s big
jazzy
band.
Jazzy, big band,
Glenn Miller Orchestra kind of throughout the whole film.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, it was an interesting mixture of orchestral and then the more swingy kind of thing. And it really helped set the tone. I thought the music...
it was great.
Music was really strong.
Yeah.
So we talked a bit about the transition from stage to screen, and you like this version, this modern version?
Yeah, I mean, I think it shows you that Shakespeare's timeless, and
I
always like when you have that takeaway. I mean, I think that they were able to transform it, and it worked really well. And I don't think that always works, because I think it was a year later they did Romeo and Juliet, Baz Luhrmann
one,
and I did not like that. It was, again, I think it shows that you can either act... do Shakespearean acting or you can't, because I think Leo DiCaprio, Claire Danes, they're great actors, but they weren't good enough for me in that one.
And yet that one was very, very popular.
Right.
But I think it was just who was in it at the time, and they were a couple of...
Baz Luhrmann, right?
Highly stylized, very romantic.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree, like, that one never worked for me on any level whatsoever.
Right.
There's one I'd like to see I've never seen. It's a Hamlet with Ethan Hawke.
Oh.
And he's like, it's a corporate takeover situation in Denmark, like it's the Denmark Corporation or something.
Because that's another one of my favorites.
Yeah, I've heard it's good.
Because Mel Gibson did a Hamlet too.
He did
I liked.
Yeah, his was a very straightforward, very traditional Hamlet. But this Ethan Hawke, I think Sam Shepard's in it too. It's a modern corporate setting.
I'd be interested in that.
And I just read online there was recently a low budget, I'm sure, because I didn't know anyone in the movie except for David Carradine. There's some Richard III set in modern day Hollywood. Someone trying to get ahead, you know.
Sure.
So you can take the story anywhere.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's so many, applications of it.
And there's so many non-official adaptations of this movie where it's just, you know, people climbing the corporate ladder, getting to the top.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right, it's totally a timeless story, this sort of Machiavellian drive for success. So the 30s setting was good, the music was great. One thing I did want to talk about was the second half of this movie. To me, there's a lot of story they have to get out of the way, all the political intrigue, all the deaths.
Yeah, they just sort of catch us up, I guess.
Yeah, and I felt it was a bit too the jump cuts to jump cut to jump cut, moving around too much, where it is on stage, someone can come on and say, well, we've had the revolt and so-and-so and so-and-so are dead. We must now sign the Magna Carta. And, you know, they can get every, right. they can do all the exposition. Mm-hmm. One person can do it.
Yeah, I didn't have trouble with that, but yeah. I can see what you mean.
I was losing my attention a bit because yeah. it was just jumping around just a little bit too much.
Mm-hmm.
Those quick cuts were taken away from the acting, which I really think is the strongest point yeah. of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked about our American cousins.
Yes.
We think they were the weakest in it.
Definitely.
Downey Jr. and Annette Bening. Everyone else seemed remarkably good.
Yeah. Now maybe they're all trained that way, you know, being English.
I bet most of them come through the Royal Shakespeare Company to a certain degree.
I think so. And I thought that I had read some time ago that Keanu Reeves had done some Shakespearean training. Someone had suggested that would be a worthwhile thing for him to do in Winnipeg.
He did Hamlet in Winnipeg yeah. several years ago. And it was apparently not bad.
No, I know. And I think that if he can do it, right?
If he can do it.
If a surfer type dude can do it, then yeah. I guess it is possible.
So you're saying you'd rather have had Keanu Reeves in this than Robert Downey?
No, I won't go that far.
Anthony
but I think
Michael Hall?
I thought it had been suggested that it would help his acting, too.
It would help anyone.
Happy yeah. help Keanu Reeves acting.
Has it? There's the
well,
question.
Well, this is this. I don't know.
So, great film. You recommend this to people?
Yeah, I loved it.
As an intro to Shakespeare, if people don't love Shakespeare, is this the kind of one you think it would be too off-putting for them?
No, because I think you can follow it.
Yeah.
You know, I think it, with like, when you read your first Shakespearean play, too, it's confusing, but you get your groove, and I think that would happen with this film, too.
Yeah, and I think even if the story's not for you, I think the costume design,
mm-hmm.
the locations they chose, all those power stations, the Battersea power stations in there as the military camp, the set designs are just so good.
Yeah.
It's really, really incredible, just a beautiful thing to look at.
Yeah.
This movie was made for £5 million.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's nothing.
Well, it just shows you don't need all the effects
no.
and the paychecks maybe.
And the, well, yeah, I bet people did this for a little bit less money.
Yeah.
Okay, so what do you think the greatest strength for this version of Richard III is?
I would just say the ability to transform Shakespeare to another time period. That was done
okay.
beautifully. And Ian McKellen, I mean, he was fantastic. I mean, he was so repulsive, but so appealing at the same time. And that's a hard thing to achieve.
Is Richard III really the first anti-hero in the history, I wonder? Because he's, yeah. you know, he's a rotten guy.
Yeah.
But you're cheering for him the
you
whole
are.
Time.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like Tony Soprano kills people, but you're really voting, you know, you're with Tony the
you
whole
are.
Way.
Yeah.
He's this wretched character, but you're on his side.
Yeah.
I think right up until the very end. I mean, Richmond's a good-looking young guy, but you're a bit sad to see Richard go.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing how somebody through their acting and words can get you on side no matter what they do or plot. Mm-hmm. I guess it's the evil in all of us.
I guess it is.
We all
right?
have a little Richard the Third in us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sorry.
Oh no, I was going to say I liked just in terms of the script and how you can adapt. I mean, the other you talked about the first soliloquy, but there's also you know a horse, a kingdom
right.
for my horse, which you know everyone you're sort of thinking how are they going to do this because they have to include it, and how are they going to do this when you know there weren't really horses everywhere. But it was amusing because he was stuck in his jeep and he can't go anywhere. And you see he's desperate, just like he should be. You know, it's stuck in the mud, and
yeah.
he's calling for a horse. And it was just, you know, it gave me a chuckle.
I wondered how they would do that, too, and it was pretty
yeah.
brilliantly done. It was, I think you're right. I think it was done for laughs because he was so over the top.
Yeah.
It's an over the top line,
yeah.
so you have to kind of go
yeah.
with it.
Yeah, because then he's just, like, maniacal, right? He's just totally nuts.
But a horse would have come in handy then.
It would have been. There were a few horses
there were.
Floating it's around. I didn't notice that.
Yeah, so I think for me, McKellen, again, was the my greatest strength in this film. Obviously he toured with this. He is Richard III.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he carried the whole film on his hunchback.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
yuck. So he was awesome. Now, Achilles heel, where do you think this movie could have improved a bit?
I'd have to say just some of the acting. Like, I'd have to say Annette Bening, for
yeah.
me, was problematic, I
okay.
think. Again, she just... It would be so difficult to deliver those lines, and I just think she didn't have the skill there.
Yeah, I wonder who they could have popped in, because I like the American angle. Like, yeah. It's interesting.
No, and I'm glad you brought that up to me. That was an interesting thing.
But approach. I'm wondering what sort of 35, 40-something in the mid-90s they could have gone
well,
with.
Well, maybe, I mean, that would be a challenge.
No, yeah, but it could. You need someone with a good presence, good mm-hmm. voice. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see who they could have gone with. For me, the weakest part, the Achilles heel, was really that direction I was talking about in the middle. Too many scene changes.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of gets bogged down a little bit, which mm-hmm. There's a lot to go through, and I understand this script was way shorter. They took half the lines of the play out, so mm-hmm. they were moving things along, mm-hmm. but it does kind of get a little bit bogged down there. I mean, it's still gorgeous to look at and all that, but the first third and then the final third are terrific. It's just a bit of that middle.
Yeah.
Middle, I could have lived with that. So wrapping up, what would you give this as a grade, do you think?
I'm going to give it an A-.
A-?
Yeah.
That's very highly recommended.
I know, it is very highly recommended. I hope people will go and see it.
I'm going to give this an A.
Wow.
I know I've been sort of trashing about this middle part, but what the hell, yeah. It's still a hell of a lot better than most.
Yeah, really, I don't see what you're saying, but it's okay.
We've got to nitpick on something.
Yeah. Gee.
What am I going to say? The Achilles heel is the credits were a bit, you know, the font yeah. was difficult to read in the credits. So yeah, I don't know what I
could... That would be my Achilles heel every movie.
It was a bit blurry.
Yeah.
Our TV screen has too many fingerprints on it yeah, from the kids. Right. That's about it. So yeah, it's awesome. Yeah. You know, I think people are intimidated by Shakespeare. But even if you don't like Shakespeare and you just want a really stylish movie with one of the best performances you're ever going to see on screen, this is certainly one to check out.
Agreed.
It's hilarious.
Hilarious.
In an evil kind of way. Like, I'm still giggling thinking just about how maniacal the guy is.
I know.
You know? Okay. So that's Richard 3. We will be back shortly with a bit of feedback. Stay tuned. All the lonely days are gone. I'm coming home. Oh, my baby, she roamed in late night. All right, and welcome back to Married with Clickers. We have some feedback.
Thank you.
We got our first voicemail,
mm-hmm.
then our second,
mm-hmm.
and our third, and our fourth.
It's contagious.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
So our first voicemail is from Uncool Cat, contributor to the GGTMC. Let's listen to what he has to say.
Hey, Scott and Cat. It's Uncool Cat, the less cool version of Cat, I imagine. Calling to say, really enjoying the show so far. Listen to episode 1 and 2 and looking forward to listening to Pretty in Pink and Runaway Train. Runaway Train, which I think is fantastic, and Pretty in Pink, which I've been told is fantastic. Really enjoyed the first two episodes. Really love High Plains Drifter, and speaking of married, on our honeymoon, mine and my wife's, they were playing High Plains Drifter at the hotel we were staying at, and I was very, enthused about it, and I turned it on and said, oh, this is one of my favorite movies. Which, of course, would be on the Rape Her Till She Likes It scene, which kind of, I'm sure my wife was thinking, oh, wow, I married this guy whose favorite scene's the rape until the woman enjoys it scene. But I quickly explained that, no, he's a demon of vengeance, which I'm sure did not appease her at all, but we're still married. And, as for Charade, love that one as well, great Criterion version, and... if you want a more updated version of Henry Mancini's score, you can always check out Phantom Asses, which is Mike Patton's band, which is very much updated. But liking the show very, very much, and great job, and I'm looking very forward to listening to the next two ASAP. Bye.
Hey, Chris, thanks for that. You are our first caller, so you're officially there's some award I'm sure we're going to give you. You got free subscription for a year to the podcast, maybe.
That's right.
Yeah, awkward moments while watching movies. Yeah.
I think we've
rape
all had
scenes
a few
on your honeymoon.
Yeah, rapes
one.
Are awkward, aren't they?
Yeah. Cool hotel, though, if they play High Plains Drifter.
That's true.
You had any of these awkward scenes with anyone watching a movie? Something make you squirm?
You know, probably as a teenager, any sex scene in a movie with my parents present. They're kind of puritanical. It's awkward.
Yeah. I remember once, I don't think I realized it at the time, but I'm sure my parents were squirming. There's a scene in The Blues Brothers where John Belushi's getting out of prison and Frank Oz is playing the clerk at the jailhouse. And he's going through his items, you know, one wallet, and he goes, one prophylactic, and pulls out this condom and goes, used. And I said, I know I said to my parents, what's that?
Yeah, that was awkward for
them. I think they said, I'm going to go make popcorn or something like that. So, hey, thanks for the email. Hope you keep listening. And who's up next? We got a voicemail here from Rupert.
Hey, Scott and Kat. This is Rupert calling. Just listened to the second episode of Married with Clickers. I'm digging the show. My wife and I watch a ton of movies together, and you know, we like to discuss, and it's pretty cool. I might have her start listening to the show, although she's not a big podcast listener herself. But I definitely like the stuff you guys are saying and what you're covering, and it's a good show. I'm into it. I just wanted to say real quick, Scott, this relates to a voicemail you left with the Gentleman's Guide that played on this week's show, and it was regarding His Kind of Woman with Robert Mitchum. I was just going to say, had I been on that show, I would definitely have had some things to say. That's a great movie. I'm a big fan. One of my favorite Vincent Price roles. I just think he's a lot of fun in that film. And that's one that you having brought it up and, you know, me being part of the Gentleman's Guide on occasion there, I might pull that into the show at some point because I think it sounded like Rick and Will hadn't seen it, and it's one that I like a lot. So thank you for pointing that one out. I was going to ask if you guys have seen a film called Looking for Mr. Goodbar. My wife and I just watched this this week. Kind of harder to see because it's not on DVD, although it was streaming on Netflix here in the U.S. up until the first of the year. An interesting film. A tough watch in some ways. A friend of mine had recommended it to me. A very interesting Diane Keaton performance. Some interesting editing. A little bit downbeat. But, yeah, I wondered if you guys had seen it and what you thought of it. Anyway, I'm looking forward to future episodes. Really enjoying the show. I'm going to go and listen to episode 3 right now. Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks.
All right, Rupert, thanks for that. You can find Rupert at his great blog, rupertpupkinspeaks.blogspot.com. He's also a regular contributor to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. Wonderfully knowledgeable guy. Also, I'm happy to have a co-fan of His Kind of Woman. That's a pretty fun movie.
It was good.
One of Vincent Price's best roles, I think. This Diane Keaton movie, Looking for Mr. Goodbar. I've never seen it. I know of it.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
As I understand, she's maybe a teacher or something, really sort of got a dull life and goes out to singles bars in 1970s New York City just throwing herself at people.
That's entertaining.
And I think it goes bad eventually.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Lots of psychological problems and all of that. And not really sort of the Diane Keaton you think of when you think of her today in these bad romantic comedies. You know, it's not exactly First Wives Club material.
Right.
So it would be interesting to check out. It's weird that some of these things never end up on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked it up. It's not on Netflix Canada. You guys are still better down there.
Yes, for sure.
For sure. So thanks for that, Rupe. Really appreciate you listening to the show. Hope you continue to listen. Next up, we've got Emily from the Glee cast with some thoughts. Let's give a listen to what she's got to say.
Hi, Scott and Kat. This is Emily from the Glee cast. Just started listening to your show, and I'm really enjoying it. Perhaps you should call it Married with Cleekers. I am an American, and I've never heard anybody pronounce the word that way. But so thank you for educating me to some Toronto speak that I did not know about. Really enjoyed your discussion of Pretty in Pink. Whenever anybody throws out a Chuck Bass comment, I'm happy. I think I agree with a lot of your thoughts on it. It's not great, but it's pretty heartfelt, and I think it still works. Wasn't really my generation. I was a little young for it. I don't know what that movie for my generation was when I think about it. I was born in 82, so the 80s movies kind of missed. I had all of them. I grew up with them because I had older siblings, but I guess I was a Dawson's Creek generation, which is really sad because I hated that show. Also, something else you were talking about, and I can't remember if it was that episode or another one, you're talking about sort of cult movies and can you have new cult movies, and I think it's an interesting question that sort of rears its head every few years. I think a prime example of that was a repo of a genetic opera, which sort of was trying really hard to be a cult movie, and part of it was it already had kind of an audience since it was a musical show, and because it was kind of just so bizarre and very aimed at, like, the goth I can't speak, it's late. Anyway, but because it sort of was aimed at this group that sort of thinks of themselves on the fringes anyway, I think it was, like, packaged as a cult movie, which is why a lot of people hate it, but that's kind of the point of cult movies, a lot of people are going to hate them anyway. I don't know what I'm saying, but that was just some food for thought. Yeah, keep up the good work. I am excited to hear more of it. Goodbye.
All right, thanks, Emily. Emily from GleeCast. That means that we're in the big leagues when Emily leaves you a voicemail, you know.
All right.
So if you don't listen to GleeCast already and you're a Glee fan, do it. Even if you don't like Glee, do it.
Sure.
We're Glee watchers. A couple of things she mentioned. She wondered what the Pretty in Pink of the mid-90s was.
Yeah.
Now, you like Dawson's Creek.
She was Pacey's okay, right? Isn't he?
Isn't it weird that Michelle Williams has done the best of everyone from that show? I never would have thought.
Yeah.
Oh, Dawson's Creek. I can't believe we're old enough to now have Dawson's Creek nostalgia.
That's right.
Anyway, Emily, I have younger sisters. They're a little bit younger than you. They were born in like 84 or something like that. But Can't Hardly Wait was their Pretty in Pink, and it's quite sad. Jennifer Love Hewitt was their Molly Ringwald. I remember them talking about that movie all the time, and it was terrible. They're like, we're going
to
go watch Can't Hardly Wait. You can wait to see it. Okay, believe me, it's not very good. Yeah, cult movies, Repo the Genetic Opera. I've never seen it. You've never seen it. I've heard terrible things about it. And I do think it seems like it's one of those prefab cult movies. Like, I think it opened here at the Toronto After Dark Festival a couple years ago or whatnot. I think the only redeeming thing is the Paris Hilton connection.
Yeah.
I'd see it for Paris. And hopefully it's a so bad, it's good kind of thing. Because apparently she won a Razzie that year for her role in it. So she's done something award worthy. So yeah, maybe we'll check that one out. Anyway, thanks for calling in. And again, check out Emily's great podcast, the Glee Cast, she does with her pal Erica.
Thanks.
Next up, we got Big Willie of the GGTMC calling in.
Hey, Scott. Hey, Kat. It's William here. Just want to let you guys know that I've listened to all four of your episodes. I was a little bit behind, as you guys can attest to, having children, working a lot. It's difficult to keep up with anything. So I was able to get all four episodes crammed in, and I have to tell you guys truly how much I love your show. I think it's fantastic. You guys got a great, great chemistry, a great dynamic, and, you know, you would think that would be a given considering you're married, but it's not a given. I've seen people that just don't have that chemistry, and you guys, you definitely do, and beyond that, I really want to commend Kat, I think above all, for something that she does that a lot of wives or spouses do not do, and that is she does not thumb her nose at genre movies or at cinema you like or things that that you enjoy, Scott. And I can't tell you how nice it is. I'm lucky enough to have a wife like that as well who embraces it a great deal. And in life, and then obviously as far as a podcast go, it certainly helps things move along quite nicely. A little disappointed you guys didn't dig The Warriors as much. It's probably a top 10 all-time favorite film for me. I love the aesthetic. I love the grit of it, the fantastical kind of nature of it. And I love that the end is really Yojimbo, of course, with the knife throw versus the gun and everything. So just Walter Hill's nod to Japanese cinema. And the soundtrack, of course, which is absolutely fantastic. I've got a lot of notes here, guys, so bear with me. Robert Ryan's character in the film you've mentioned a few times, Scott, really reminds me. It sounds like Bud White from L.A. Confidential. I'd like to see a movie with Billy Dee Crystal, which I think you mentioned on an earlier episode. So you guys talked about Chuck Norris and being indifferent. My wife hates him. I'm a little heartbroken you didn't bring up De Silva, because I believe he's in Code of Silence, Scott. I love that Kat mentioned bulges in 3D. I had a good chuckle out of that. Again, a lot of this isn't going to make sense. It's kind of four episodes worth crammed into one. Again, I want to commend you both on your sense of humor throughout the show. It's really a testament to you guys and your film knowledge. I want to know what film or films you guys disagree on most. You guys seem to be fairly in line with each other in terms of sensibility and taste. It's a bit of a sliding scale, but what do you guys really disagree on? I'd be very curious about that. I love that you guys call the heart attack from the train conductor in Runaway Train the most plot-friendly heart attack in the history of cinema. I got a very good laugh out of that. I loved all the Thomas the Train stuff in that episode. I thought it was genius. My son, William, is just obsessed to no end with Thomas. So to hear the music at the end and hear talk of Sir Topham Hatt and biffing and bashing. Sadly, no really useful engine talk, though. But anyway, Voight, he talked about his accent, his brother, and his sucker talk. That reminded me kind of Luther from The Warriors, to bring it back to that. Luther meets Christopher Walken, and Eric Roberts, to me, spoke a lot like Forrest Gump. And De Mornay was great, I thought, in that a very unglamorous role. I mean, we seem to forget a few years prior she had been in Risky Business, slightly different role. Yeah, All-Star Hoarder sounds amazing. You guys have talked about that. Also hate Andrew McCarthy, and I am indifferent and to the point of probably not liking John Cusack. Some films I'd love to hear you guys cover would be Peeping Tom, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, Fellini's 8.5, Blade Runner, The Twilight Samurai, Ellie Fury to the Soul, or All That Heaven Allows, The American Friend, which is American Friend or Paris, Texas. Those are both Wim Wenders films. And you guys mentioned Supernatural Westerns, actually, just to kind of bring it to an end here. Another one I can think of stars Klaus Kinski, and that is And God Said to Cain. It has some great mood, suspense. It's not executed anywhere near as well as High Plains Drifter. And that's it, guys. Again, I really mean this sincerely. Keep up the great work. You guys have a niche and a market covered by you being a couple to the podcast about film, and it's not dead weight. Both of you are passionate about film and pop culture, and it shows in your show, and it's only going to grow. So keep up the great work, guys. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, and thank you for the kind words.
Thank you, yes.
You made us feel
overwhelmed,
like we're running the best show on earth here.
Yeah, and that I'm a good wife. I like hearing that.
She does thumb her nose at some things, just not movies necessarily. Maybe there's a few comic books downstairs that get their nose thumbed
at. I am very tolerant. You're correct on that.
Yeah, very. She's very, very tolerant. So thanks, because, you know, Willie, he's like a godfather podcasting, like a podfather of sorts out here. So high praise from him is really, really great. So The Warriors, yeah, he says it's one of his top 10 movies. I mean, I think we both liked it.
Oh, yeah, it was entertaining.
Yep. And, yeah, I don't know. Again, what you're talking about, Will, that whole aesthetic, that fantastical, I think this, I'd call it universe building, Walter Hill did in that, is probably my favorite thing in it, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
This all parallel universe New York,
mm-hmm.
That's just so cool. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, The Warriors is a good one, you know, and it's very rewatchable, probably. I wouldn't be surprised if it gets a revisit someday.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I did misspeak about Billy Dee Crystal, but I do think that would be he'd be a very intriguing actor.
I'd love to see
a movie with Billy Dee Crystal. I don't know, sort of a half Lando Calrissian, half when Lando met Sally, something like that. That would be awesome. Yeah, I totally screwed up not mentioning Henry Silva's appearance in Code of Silence, Will. But you know why I think it was? He's second billed in that movie, but he's not in it that much. He's great in it, but he didn't get enough screen time. Chuck just wanted Chuck all the time, I guess. So Thomas. Yeah, we do watch Thomas.
We do.
A lot. But Will, you may find that your little guy might veer away.
Yeah, it's true.
There are other...
It's sort of a sad point when that happens.
Yeah.
They do move on.
Our 5-year-old's still into him from time to time, but
yeah.
He's found other things. It's not all Thomas all the time now.
No.
But, you know, maybe we'll invite Will to come co-host with us when we cover Hero of the Rails on the podcast in a future episode. That would be the world's worst podcast. So, yeah, Thomas. Now, he asked what we disagree on the most. In terms of movies.
In terms of movies. Let's be clear.
The general list is a long one. The movies list is probably a short one. What do you disagree with me about? I think you probably like costume dramas a bit more than I would period pieces.
I do.
Things with Mr. Darcy and whatnot.
Of course.
People named Heathcliff.
Yeah.
The only Heathcliff for me is the cat.
You should just walk around in a morning suit all the time.
I should. And for me, like, I don't know. I have such great taste, it's hard to disagree with me.
Yeah, well, for me, it's like the sentimental sports movies. Field of Dreams. Sentimental sports.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that. You didn't play catch with your dad as a young lad.
Because my dad can't throw a ball. No.
So, yeah, I, you know, and I can understand, like, a movie like Field of Dreams, I can understand why people can't stand it. And at times, I can't stand it, but... whatever, it's one of those movies that comes out for you at the right, in the right circumstances, the right time, and just kind of clicks. But yeah, I think for the most part we agree. Like, mm-hmm. I like all the Star Wars movies. You like the Star Wars movies, you know? Even the the newer ones. For sure. But you know, as the stuff that would be quote unquote traditionally guy stuff. The sci-fi movies, war movies, yeah, westerns. You're into all that stuff, I'd say. Spider-Man 2 might be one of them. The overacting in the subway scene really stuck with you more. I forgave.
Oh, and Doc Ock. I liked Willem Dafoe. I liked the first one. Yeah, that was Willem Dafoe, right?
I really liked Spider-Man 2. I remember that was one. I forgave it more than you did, I think. Mm-hmm. How about Gone with the Wind?
Boy, that sat with you for a while then.
Well, that was one that came to mind today. Because every time I talk about how much I love Spider-Man 2, you're always like, what about that shitty acting at the front of the subway?
Yeah, that was
terrible. You try to ruin the movie for
me. Sorry.
Gone with the Wind. What do you think of Gone with the Wind?
I like Civil War. Just, you know, as a time period to study. And it's... whatever.
You'd rather watch Glory than Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, I would.
See, I've married the perfect woman.
Yeah, true. There you go.
Because I can't stand Gone with the Wind. There's not enough Rhett Butler in it, first of all.
Yeah, so Vivian Leigh just drives me nuts.
Drives me absolutely
I mean, there's a lot of stereotyping that goes on in that, too. But, I mean, I guess that's, you know, accurate for the period.
Yeah, right? Well-made, well-shot movie, but I can't stand it. And you're supposed to love it, and we're supposed to disagree, but you don't love it.
That's right.
It's perfect.
There you go.
Well, watch Glory.
Okay.
And so then Will went on to suggest a few movies we should cover, like Peeping Tom, 8.5, Blade Runner, we both seen, but yes. Haven't seen it in a while, I guess.
I'd love to look at that again.
Yeah, for sure. And we've been, you know, I've read more Philip K. Dick in recent years, and I think you read at least one. So I'd be interested in seeing it since I've become more familiar with Dick. That sounded totally wrong.
More familiar with Dick.
And
a little Dick obsessed.
Yes. And one you mentioned, Will, which really intrigues me, is called An American Friend. That Wim Wenders movie with Dennis Hopper. Because it's based on the book Ripley's Game, the sequel to The Talented Mr. Ripley, which I read not too long ago. So yeah. I'd be interested in checking it. I didn't realize it was based on that book until you and Samurai covered it on your show. But it's an older Ripley, and it's a great book, fantastic book. There was a version done a few years ago with John Malkovich starring as Ripley, but I assume it's Dennis Hopper in this. It's from the late 70s, so... I'd be very interested in seeing that. Maybe that's one...
those are some great suggestions.
Great suggestions. Yeah. We've jotted them all down. Peckinpah's Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia is an interesting one to cover for sure. We should check that out. So thanks so much, Will. Really appreciate the call. And I guess that's it for tonight's show. Any final thoughts? No, zero thoughts?
Had a blast.
Thanks so much for tuning
in. Thank you.
And we shall see you next time. Good night. In the right
measure. Cruel to be kind, it's the very design. But cruel to be kind means that I love you, baby. Off.